Hi everyone, it's Ian Gardner again with another fabulous episode. Yeah, a great one today. Ben Pfisterer, who is the founder and CEO at Zeller, myzeller.com. It's a payments app. An amazing story. So he only founded this business with his three co-founders a year and a half ago, so around about the beginning of 2020. He's gone on to raise $75 or $80 million in total over three rounds. First round came kind of within, you know, before they'd even launched. So they've built a payments platform. They've covered all the regulatory stuff. They've hired 100 people. They're in market now. They built and released the product within a year. Traction's incredible. Lovely guy. Super smart. Loads of lessons in here. So I really enjoyed this. It's great coming across founders who are as ambitious and fast moving and capable as Ben. So let's jump over to the show and hear from Ben. Hello, everyone. This is the show. We are here with Ben Pfisterer from Zeller. Welcome, Ben, all the way from Melbourne.
Thanks for having me.
And not in lockdown, but we are. So it's a little bit of a role reversal. Are you enjoying not being in lockdown and smiling at us?
No, we're not taking any happiness from seeing you guys go through what we went through. But if it makes you feel better, we were in lockdown for months. So you're still in the junior league. So.
Yeah, I got to say, we're not enjoying it. And I don't want this podcast to become just Ian whinging about lockdown every single time we come on. So I really want to talk about Zeller because it is pretty amazing business. Maybe I'll just start with some really broad picture. I mean, you started the business early last year. You'd had a history as the country manager for Square, which has been in the news as well, and we might touch on that. But remarkably, I mean, you raised a huge amount of money. I mean, I think over $50 million in total over a couple of rounds. SquarePeg was an early investor. Spark out of New York has chucked in a big check. You've got almost 90 people and hiring very thoroughly or very actively right now, which is a pretty amazing story. So it kind of part of the reason we wanted to get you on because you've gone from zero to this in almost no time. And you're still just about getting your product up and running and into the market. So what have I missed there? Like maybe tell us a bit more about Zeller that I didn't touch on there because it is an amazing story.
Yeah, sure. Zeller came about at the start of 2020 and it was myself, Dave, Alfred and Dom got together and we'd sort of known each other in different angles for a while. We're all very deeply into the payments and financial services space and for us, we just recognized that in the market, it was in Australia for business banking and payment services, very similar to a lot of other markets. There was just a massive gaping hole that only incumbents were servicing. And so we had to look at what every business needs. And in Australia, it's very clear they need a better way to accept payments faster, more effectively, cheaper. They need better technology to integrate new services, whether it is buy now, pay later, point of sale systems, all that sort of thing. That's one part of it. And then we realized that they also need somewhere to put their money. And often when you go to a payments provider, you then have to go to a bank and set up a business transaction account. So we thought, can we put those two things together and do it better than everyone else is doing it in market? And we believed we could. And then the third part of it was, well, we're helping businesses take payments, we're helping people hold their money, but they also need to put their money to work to reduce the complexities and issues that can come from lack of cash flow. So the third part of the equation was, could we put a business transaction account in there? So putting those three products in, being payments, account and card, into a single solution and do it like no one else is doing it and make sure we can look after Australian businesses. So, yeah, we launched, you know, we got that idea before COVID hit. We've been growing all the way through the craziness of COVID and we're still going, obviously. And for us, before we started, we knew Australian business needed a service like Zeller. And I think due to the complexity and the economic conditions that we've seen from COVID, I think our reason for being and our mission is more valid than ever. And we're thrilled to be able to help businesses come out of this COVID mess.
And what was the underpinning thesis? Was it just that the big four banks are lazy and slow and you could do it better? I mean, was that part of the background here?
Yeah, a big part of it was we thought the big four bank solutions and they hold, you know, 90%+ market share in all those three categories. And they weren't integrating it. They weren't innovating much. They're very commoditized across the four of them. They weren't looking out for the genuine needs of Australian businesses and payments and financial services evolving ridiculously quickly. And these products just weren't keeping up. So we thought we could do that. We thought we could innovate. We could do it at a better cost and a better rate and help businesses onboard faster. And Yeah, I mean, the growth rate we're seeing now, that thesis has been proven to be more than correct.
And so you are in market, so products out there, customers have got it in hand, and you're seeing transactions flowing, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think probably one of the most exciting thing, and I'm most proud about the whole Zella team, was we managed to build this solution, which is effectively a two-sided financial services business, being acquiring and issuing. Managed to build that in just over 12 months, which was pretty amazing and testament to the talent we have on board. And we launched on May the 4th. And no, I'm not a massive Star Wars fan.
I was going to say Star Wars Day.
Right, linked to that, but I was some fun with it as well. And so we've been in market for about 3 months, but yeah, in the first month, we're a little bit different to other businesses where we didn't believe in pushing an MVP out and doing something super scrappy and then building over a year or something. We knew that if you're dealing with people's money, you've got to do it seriously. You've got to take it seriously. And so when you launch your products, it has to be really robust and sound. So we had to hit the ground running with really formidable, trustworthy, and effective products. So when we hit the ground running, we've since grown really quickly. So in the first month, we signed up over 1,500 businesses. So for us, that was a massive validation, very exciting to see that trust won from and just from the start. And since then, even despite the lockdowns, we're growing exponentially. So yeah, we're just
and can you give us a typical use case? Like who's those 1,500 early customers? Like who are they?
Sure. I mean, when you're building a business like Zella, you go in to with a lot of thesis, a lot of assumptions, a lot of predictions of what you're going to do and who you're going to appeal to. And something that I got very wrong was I assumed we'd be better suited to businesses getting set up. So they get that all that business banking and payments in a box, ease of setup, you're starting a new business. We thought we'd appeal to those, and out of COVID with so many new businesses probably starting up now with this new entrepreneurial spirit, we'd appeal to them. But since our launch, 80% of them are switchers. So 80% of businesses that sign up for Zella are actually coming from incumbent banks or other providers like Tyro and Square and moving across because, they're not meeting their needs. So, we're thrilled that that's happening. But it was a bit of a surprise. But we appeal to businesses of all size. Like we weren't built for micro mobile businesses. That's more the domain of someone like Square. We're more about that. Businesses are starting to grow, get a better footprint, maybe a shop front or starting to scale. But it can be used by any business, any vertical as well.
Yeah. And long-term plan. I mean, I read in there was a piece in the AFR in June that said, your plan is now to become a bank. Can you touch on that?
Yeah, there's a lot of interest and attention on whether we're going to become a bank and become regulated and get our ADI or our RADI. But, for us, that's not an end goal. That's not even a milestone. It's something that you have to do when you get to a particular point with particular products. So we currently don't have an ADI. We don't need it with the product sets we've got. But there will be a time as we go deeper into financial services and banking services that we'll have it. But that said, we've always built our business ready to be regulated, very strong in risk and compliance in the way we manage our business. So we don't see it as a huge hurdle when we get there. So when we do, we will. But yeah, it's not imminent.
Yeah. Look, there's so much to unpack here that I really want to get into. I mean, that statement you made about that 12 months from when you started building to when you actually launched the product. I mean, it's not just the fact that, this is money. It's a regulated environment. It's incredibly complex from a technical perspective to build something like this, but it's also complicated from a regulatory perspective and from building your team out perspective and from raising the money to be able to do that perspective. And it's kind of like this whole catch-22. I mean, like you can't build something unless you have something normally, but you had to raise the money before you did it. So, I mean, let's rewind all the way. Like how the hell did you raise so much money on the back of what sounds like a napkin? I mean, I'm sure it wasn't, by the way, but it was a little more than that. But I think you said a 10-point PowerPoint deck or 10 slide.
No, we didn't actually we never pitched and we never went to raise money, which is kind of it's just an amazing time in general, and I think our timing we were very lucky, and it's a combination of we're an experienced team, the founding team, so we weren't like a group of people saying, hey, let's get into fintech, let's work out this whole banking thing. We know a lot of the pieces already, and it's not our first business in this space, so we came to it with a lot of knowledge. We understood what to build, how to build it. I mean, we didn't know everything by any stretch. So I think when we first talked in the first conversations with Square Peg and Athena, Apex Capital, We just got an investment by a home loan business. Apex Capital. And for us, it was literally just having a conversation, and we met with Paul Bassett. I wasn't pitching to raise money. I didn't think we actually, naively, I didn't think we needed it at that point. We're still just getting started. And when you meet certain people like those two teams, they know a lot about this space and they know what they're looking for in founding teams. And I think what we offered probably resonated with them. So the conversation went really quickly. And within, I think it was 10 days, we had raised $6 million. And so we weren't doing a process. We didn't do a pitch. We didn't, put a deck across. So it was pretty amazing. But every round just got faster, and we ended up raising $81 million before we'd even launched a product. But along that way, we laid out what we had to do and why we would succeed. So there was a sequence to it. And so when we got, the bigger check size and the new investors, we were showing progress. It wasn't just we're stumbling along. We were showing how, and we got to that last point before we launched. So the last $50 million we raised, we had built our products and they were ready to go. And they were in the final stages of testing. So it wasn't a massive risky bet in terms of, are these guys actually going to put this product together? There was still an unknown element. Will they scale the business? Will they succeed? But I think over time, we just ticked off a lot of their concern areas of, so they get more comfortable investing, which is why probably the most proud thing is all our investors have always come in for pro rata subsequent rounds. So no one's opted out ever in the subsequent round. So for us, we're really proud of that because we know we've got close relationship with our investors and we've been able to show them that we're delivering on that promise.
Yeah. And so it's been two rounds. So you mentioned the $6 million was led by Square Peg, and that was sort of 10 days after you met Paul, which sounds amazing. Was there a second round? Maybe just touch on the fundraising process if you could.
Yeah, sure. So the first one was the $6.3 million with Apex Square Peg Capital.
Just on that, did Paul make the intro to Apex, or was that you guys that knew them?
No. So both the intros were to both those VCs were via Mike Starkey at Athena Home Loans, which is why I stumbled across that.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, he lives next door to my brother. And they were just sharing stories about how he was starting Athena. He was a few years ahead of us. So my brother and his wife, Rowan and Lisa, suggested, hey, why don't you catch up with this guy, Mike? And so we caught up for coffee. And if anyone met him, he's a really nice guy. And he's very, very...
Yeah, he's a lovely guy. He's done some events with us.
Yeah, he's one of the rare ones. There's not too many people in the space that are really giving with their time. And he was amazing. So he was just talked through the pros and cons of what he'd gone through. And I was learning a bit from him. And he said, well, you'd be crazy not to raise money. Go have a chat to these two if you want to. It went from there. So yeah, it was introed by Mike. And obviously the two.
So it was the first two you talked to, you took the money from. So you didn't do it through a process or anything. It was just kind of like, well, this feels right. Let's do it.
No, I did have that little bit of a doubt at one point going, hang on, the first two we met, we'll just take money from. Should we have done something? But then, it doesn't take too long. You step back, you look at the caliber of both those organizations and the individuals that run them, and they're best in class in Australia. So I think we're a bit lucky that the first outreach was the best in class. But, we knew we were privileged to get such strong backing literally within a couple of weeks of getting the team together. Like, we had nothing. We never named.
Oh, look, totally. I mean, I think if you ask anyone who's in the know in this sector, said who would be the best investors for a business like this, then they would be top of the list, especially Paul. I mean, he's just he's a legend.
Yeah, definitely. To be honest, it was similar with after 6 months that we started to get a little bit of media about it, and we didn't like shout about raising money because we don't see that as an end state. But I think a piece was in the AFR and a little piece was in New York Times or something, just referencing us. Lee had this thesis that he was working on. He's just obviously left Tiger and he was setting up his own fund, and he had this looking into companies that he respected, and one of them was Square, and just trying to work out people that had worked at Square for a long time and had started a business of what they were doing, and happened to stumble across my name, and we had a chat. And he's a very, definitely a different type of investor, very humble, very behind the scenes, but moves very quickly and knows the space very well. So that was an even faster process, I think 5 days to get that. So we got $25 million. So that was amazing. And then the last $50 million round was just before we launched.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that I was telling you before I was listening to this podcast about just how fast Tiger moves. And I know Lee's not there anymore, but maybe some of that instinct. I mean, it tends to be, and I've heard this from some of the, you know, the big founders here that have raised money from them. I mean, one of them, it was a 30-minute meeting. He got $100+ million check. And he said, so do you need anything for this? Like, do you want information rights? And he says, no, just make it work. I mean, I'm paraphrasing here, but it's kind of like this real hands-off, find the best founders, put the money in their hands and let them get on with it.
It's certainly, I mean, Tiger, well known for that, and definitely a different approach. But, you know, once you chat to a lot of the more fast-moving funds, you understand why. From the outside, it seems perplexing, but they see so many founders, so many business. They've run the numbers over them. They understand the sectors. They do all the pre-work. So yeah. When they do come, it's more around not so much as cold as ticking boxes, but that they can pick up quicker if it's the type of investment they're looking for. So you kind of get why they can move fast. If they'd never heard about your sector or your skill or your product, it would obviously take a lot longer. But yeah, it's staggering and awesome that businesses can raise that fast, because that's what you need as a new business. You need speed. If you don't have speed, it doesn't work. So when those align, they're pretty special.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Maybe let's touch on your team, because you touched on them before, but I don't think we've heard too much about the rest of them. So, I mean, maybe start with you. I mean, your main CV item for this is, I think, 5 years as the country head for Square, which is the payments organization that's been in the news recently, led by Jack Dorsey. Maybe you could touch on that, but I'd love to hear about the rest of the team as well.
Yeah, sure. So now I've sort of, for some reason, been in the payments and innovation space for quite a while. And that was probably one of the more difficult roles that I had, but definitely one I loved in terms of being able to bring a brand into market and, you know, be the first person in Australia working for Square and build it up. So on one hand, it was extremely similar to starting your own business, but it was a little bit different, obviously, where, you know, you didn't have to build the tech and hire the engineers, but everything else was pretty much the same in terms of, you know, hiring, growth, marketing, comms, customer support, strategy, sales, all those typical roles and functionalities you have to build. We had to build from scratch. And, you know, it was tough the first time. Like, we didn't get a lot of support in the industry. You know, we were this new entrant coming from the US, and it was hard to get going. And there was a lot of conjecture about whether the solution that you plug into a phone, surely this thing isn't safe. And so the industry was unsure about it and pushed back a lot on it. But eventually we had a lot of resilience and we pushed through and managed to launch it. And it had I learned a lot about hiring highly motivated, aligned staff at the start. So the team was really small, but we just scaled really quickly. And so I think at the time, there was a lot about what hard work that the team put in, but also the timing was right for someone like Square. But in Australia, the same thing prevails, where the industry is too tightly held by too few. So, you know, Square scaled really quickly. Those 6 years were amazing for me. I really enjoyed them. But by the end of it, Square wasn't the company that I joined at the start. It had changed. And they do. It's not a problem. But it was starting to move slower. It didn't have that growth mindset anymore that I wanted to see. So it was, you know, time for me to do something different. And they were making decisions about my team and reporting lines that didn't work for me at all. So, you know, it was a nice little bookend. Loved it, though.
Yeah.
Square's a great company. And really privileged now to have an amazing team. I think we've almost hit 100 people now. But, yeah, the first four, Alfred Wong, David Conn, and Dominic Yap. I knew Dave from many years ago. We crossed paths when I was trying to do a mobile payments pilot, but that was it. He was just a really smart engineer, and I loved his can-do attitude but very relaxed nature. Dom worked with me at Square and was still around superstar and knowing that space and knew what it meant to grow a company fast. So he was an absolute no-brainer to join forces with. And Alfred was actually a friend of a contact, but he's been in the payment space for a long time, exceptionally talented, you know, lead engineer and CTO in his own right. So, yeah, it was a great team to bring together. And having that balance of two tech and two business was, I think, a really, really strong starting point.
Yeah, and those, so that is the founding team. So have you all got ordinary shares? I mean, are you the only ones on that level of the cap table?
No, yes, and from that perspective. But I'm personally a very strong believer in every person that works with us should be an owner of the business. Obviously, it's a more commonly seen thing in San Francisco and the US and what have you. But I saw firsthand at Square what that does to motivate people and align your interests and cut out a lot of the sort of usual rubbish you'd have in a business, politics and bureaucracy and stuff. So that was, for me, it was an absolute necessity. So even today, the 100 people coming on board, everyone has a piece of the business and they know, you know, if anything they do is, you know, they're aligned, they're motivated to build the business together, and, you know, there's not, you know, two classes of people in the organization that are benefiting, not benefiting. So
I think to your point about a few years ago, I think it was fair to say that most Australian employees in startups didn't actually care that much about equity. I think that is definitely changing. You just have to look at, I mean, even the story, maybe we'll touch on this next, but the, you know, Square acquiring Afterpay. I mean, that's a $40 billion transaction. And, you know, I don't know Afterpay's cap table, but I'm sure there's some early employee, you know, multimillionaires off the back of that. So staff see, you know, transactions like that and they start paying attention. So I think it's, you know, it's great that I think every good founder is doing this, but if you're out there and you're thinking about whether you should have a ESOP employee share option program, you should.
Oh, absolutely.
I think that's fair to say.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you see it straight away, like when you hit a milestone or an event or something and you celebrate it, you're actually genuinely celebrating it together. You're aligned. So it makes a lot of sense. And you're also asking a lot of people, like, as when you look back on a company, whether it's looking back on Afterpay, Square or Zella, and you can kind of say, oh, well, of course it's a success. Why wouldn't have people joined? But all those companies would have faced the same thing at the very start, is that the people that join them, there's a massive risk. It's a huge risk. You know, people have got their own careers to care about. They've got their own financial situation. So you have to motivate them from that perspective and you have to show them that you're in it together. So, yeah, for me, it's a no-brainer to do that, and I've always been a big fan of it and will continue to be.
Yeah. Look, if you don't mind, I wouldn't mind just touching on that sort of, you know, real macro helicopter view of the industry. And the Square acquisition of Afterpay is material. I mean, it was a $40 billion transaction. I mean, Afterpay was kind of it's a huge company, and it's done an astonishing job in a short amount of time in the buy now, pay later space. You know, I know you're a little bit conflicted because you don't want to go into, you know, what Square should and shouldn't have done, but I mean, however you cut it, it's a big transaction. I mean, it's about 20% of Square's market cap on one transaction. It's a huge deal for the Afterpay guys, but maybe let's start the answer with just your, you know, high level view of the market, especially that buy now, pay later space and how it fits with payments.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to unpack in that first part of buy now, pay later. But looking at the deal, I'm a big fan of the deal. I think it's a great move. I met Nick and Anthony, I think, 4 or 5 years ago when they were sort of starting to ramp up. And anyone that's met them knows them. They're also one of those types of founders where they're incredibly ambitious. They were onto something that was clearly working. The growth rates early on were phenomenal. But they were also quite humble and grounded people. And when you get a combination of those sort of smart people doing the right thing with the right products, it is pretty special. So, I introduced Nick to the San Francisco Square team, I think about 4 years ago. And, quite quietly, I really wanted Square to take a stronger look at him early on.
So you can take credit for this transaction?
100% not. No, no, I had nothing to do with this transaction.
You should be sending them a success fee.
No, not at all.
The way around, sorry.
Not at all. I mean, but no, for me, commenting on things like, you know, Athena and that, the founders there, and the same thing with Afterpay, although I obviously only met Nick and Anthony a few times, but you see it in founders. You see that something that's different and special, a combination of talent and passion and something different with their products. And I saw it, as many people have since seen it. We saw it with those guys. And so it wasn't like how amazing an insight from me by any stretch, but it was clear to anyone that was meeting them, they're on something pretty special. And when you see something like that, you want to tell people about it. And that's the way I felt. And I thought that was a great thing. But yeah, looking back, I didn't know that, and no one knew at that time, that buy now, pay later would become the sector that it's become, and the size that it's come, and the interest and level of investment. So no, I thought they were good operators more than anything. So at the time it just wasn't aligned. There wasn't interest there, but clearly looking at the deal now, and I definitely had nothing to do with it. I think it's a great move by Square. I think it's, people have questioned some of their former or their prior investments, and purchases of companies. But this one is aligned. It makes sense. It's a good growth engine. It's harder to innovate when you're at that size. So purchasing becomes more of a viable option to get the scale you need to keep scaling. So it makes sense from that. I'm a little bit surprised, not that they should care about my view, but I'm a little bit surprised that Afterpay are kind of selling now. I think earlier in the story, you could imagine it when probably things were a bit more question marks, but they've done so well to push through to mainstream and get such market share and grow and go global. It is a little bit strange they're doing it now. I could see it later in the maturity of the business, but yeah, clearly it aligned, and clearly the Square offer and the team offered Afterpay something they liked. So
yeah. Like, I can see, like it could be just. I'm not an expert in this space, and we've got no real exposure in it. But you know, the commoditization potentially of that. That asset. I mean, it is becoming competitive, and you know, what can Afterpay do longer term to remain different? You know, and maybe that's what was going behind them. Plus, it looked like a really good price. I mean, they got almost a 30% premium in their closing price in the day that was announced. So it was seemed like a good deal to me.
Yeah, I don't know. Two minds on it, because I think if you ask, and I haven't asked this question, I haven't spoken to them recently, but if you ask Nick and Anthony, like, are you scared about what lies ahead? Are you scared by further regulatory, scared by more competition? I'd be shocked if they didn't say no, and not at all, because they have such an amazing market position. They've made it through some of the different. Yeah, it's going to get harder, it's going to get more regulated, but they're well positioned to handle that. So I don't think they did it out of fear. Their market cap has been higher than they sold out at, so that's a perplexing thing as well. Yeah, maybe there was an element of that, but you know, you have to think that they saw something special in the offer and more of an alignment to make the deal. So who knows? Only they can answer.
Yeah, maybe just as an aside before we move on. I mean, like, Jack Dorsey, can he really still run Twitter and Square? I mean, they're both getting bigger, and is he as good as Elon Musk? It's a tough question for you to answer.
Yeah, having not worked with Elon, I can't do a review on that. Jack certainly manages teams and businesses in a different way, and it's very hands-off, and he empowers the teams below him to do their job. So it is actually quite viable that you can manage both. Yeah, it's difficult, definitely, but he doesn't go about it blindly and try to micromanage and juggle too much. He does take a very different approach. So it is feasible. Obviously, as they move into other services, can he take doing this? Only up to him to decide. And obviously, if you look at their share price, obviously, if that's an indicator of success, he's doing a pretty good job.
Yeah, no, I think so. Yeah, and I think, you know, COVID in some ways has helped some companies, and I think everyone has had some form of headwind, but I think a company like Square and Afterpay as well have had just a huge tailwind in the last year and a half. So, you know, and hopefully you as well, Ben. So, you know, it certainly sounds like it. Let's touch on resilience. I mean, it was like we had a pre-podcast call last week, and, you know, it came up a couple of times just around the challenges you've had with doing this and just how tough it's been just in your overall journey. So, I mean, do you want to unpack that a bit and just maybe try and give some lessons around, you know, why you should never give up?
I think if I look back at my career, the one thread of the things that I worked on, I tended to gravitate towards things that were hard. I don't know why. I don't know if it's because I'm stubborn or I get bored easily or so. I don't know. But I think I took a while to work out the industry and what I wanted to do with my career, but I knew that there was this thing that I liked being challenged. And if I was going to go to work and work for someone else, I want to do stuff that's hard. And it turns out that the ultimate challenge of a difficult thing is starting businesses. So I guess in hindsight, on looking back, it was a logical thing for me to get to that point. But so I learned a lot about resilience, like, you know, pulling off sort of big things like, you know, running mobile payments pilots at a bank and deploying Visa PayWave and stuff like that. It's hard. It was hard. It was personally, you know, draining to get that stuff. You know, when you look back at it, it seemed easy, but I knew it would take a personal strain on me at the time, but I actually really enjoyed it, and that's why I got out of bed. So, you know, starting Square, as I mentioned, it was really hard. And those first 2 years there was no guarantee that we'd succeed. I think there was a lot of internal pressure at Square that it was getting too hard and it's not going to work and we should shut down this Australian thing. So I had to fight that. And, you know, the small team that I had, which I'm thrilled to say a lot of them work at Zella now, but they learned the lessons of resilience as well. So when you're at that point where you've got everything to lose, you find a little bit more in yourself. So some of the reason I think that the founding team has been able to be move so quickly with Zella and be so resilient is that we've all, you know, it's not the first time we've done it and we've all faced real challenges, as a lot of people do starting businesses. So once you've got that perspective of saying, you know, just because it's hard, that you can get through it and you can survive and you can thrive. Once you've got that backstory and you've seen it before, it's easy to do it again. You have the confidence you can get through. So I think that's part of, although what we've achieved at Zella so far, and we're only getting started, obviously, we've done so much in building a team and a product and infrastructure and growing the brand already. Yeah, it's not the first time we've done a lot of that stuff. So I think we have the confidence that we can do it well because we've had that. We've made mistakes in the past, and yeah, you make mistakes now, but if you keep pushing, you can get through it.
And do you want to just touch on the difference between, I mean, both Square when you were doing it as the country manager and what you're doing now as the CEO and one of the founders of a brand new business. I mean, they're both hard, but the reality now is that the buck stops with you. I mean, at Square, it wasn't your company. I'm sure you had some shareholdings, but nothing like what you've got now. How do you feel about the difference between those two?
I kind of always felt like the buck did stop with me at Square in Australia. And you're right, it didn't. Like if Square didn't work, you know, that's right, Square didn't work, Square continues. But once you start hiring people and convincing them of what you're trying to do, you feel a personal responsibility to those as individuals and then their families and their careers and that. So I always felt very heavily the responsibility of the people I hired. So when there was a chance, and there was a chance for 2 years that Square Australia wouldn't actually launch, I took that personally. And that's, you know, if I needed any motivation to work 7 days a week and all night, I had that easily in these people trying to work for them. And I'd taken a lot of personal risk as well. But no, you're right. But that's what I've also really enjoyed about Zella is that, you know, that founding team of this four of us, and, you know, I'm not doing it myself. And we also brought in straight away a lot of people that we highly respected from our former lives and careers and got them in the team. So, and we all share that. So now if I was the only person, sole founder, and no one else had done it before, it was all down to me and I was micromanaging, I would feel it really, really heavily, but that's not the case. And I think we all share it together, but I've never seen such a motivated, passionate bunch of people. So a lot of our, whatever you call it, secret special sauce or whatever, it's all about, like, that team is really, really deep, yeah, really special. So
yeah, and there's a lot of chat, and we've talked about it a lot on this podcast, but you know, the mental health challenges of running founding a startup, being a senior team member, or in fact any team member in a startup, it's really hard, and it's often not talked about. You know, and the brave ones who, you know, can show that vulnerability do talk about it. But I mean, how do you deal with the mental health pressures that come with this? And you know, and maybe extending that answer to what about your team?
Yeah. Firstly, I applaud you for raising that topic and asking that question. I'm a huge, you shouldn't say fan of the space because I'm a fan of it, but
I know what you mean. It's an important topic.
No, I've seen it so many times. I've seen people struggle with it. I've worked with it. I've gone through, you know, struggles in you know, doubting myself and building businesses. And I think people that say they don't, maybe there's a rare breed that don't feel it, but I think everyone feels it. You'd be insane and insensitive and whatever if you don't feel it personally. I think there's an inherent thing of starting a business or being in a startup is that even if you're you're CEO, you're feeling it. But anyone that joins, you've kind of been entrenched in you that, you know, how special this thing is and how important it is, and you're living it each day and it might survive. Everyone in the team feels that. And so if you think it's isolated to the CEO or the leadership, you're wrong. Anyone in that business can feel that same sort of pressure. And it's also, you have to have a really strong outward confidence to do it, to convince people that the mission's right and what we're doing is right, why we're different. So that confidence can often get mixed up for people where they see such confidence in entrepreneurs and then go, why aren't I that confident? And then get riddled with that self-perpetuating anxiety that can lead to other things. And so I think more conversations have to be had about that. And, you know, I haven't got the secret formula for solving that at all. But one thing I spoke about a lot at Square when I was launching or building the team, and we talk about a lot at Zella, is that anxiety, imposter syndrome, call it what you will, all the way through to depression is real. And statistically speaking, a big part of your team, and particularly in the space of entrepreneurialism, there's a higher propensity. A big part of your team will be struggling with things which they can't talk about or might be comfortable talking about it. So we've always been strong as like saying, yeah, it's, you know, it's an infinitely personal thing, but you're surrounded by people that are here for you. And if you want to talk about it, we'll talk about it. And if you need to take actions in your life, whether that's, you know, leaving it and taking a more comfortable route, whether that's taking time off, whether that's just voicing it, making your manager know that you're struggling and stuff, we're really strong on it. But also you can't force people to do things. It's a personal journey as well.
But you must feel sometimes that, you know, you're a bit of a chameleon as a founder CEO, because, you know, if something's going hard, or, you know, you're fundraising, you know, you're running, you've got runway and you've got 2 months left and your fundraising's not going well, that's just eating you up inside. But you've got to kind of have this, you know, shit, yeah, let's keep going, boys and girls, you know, and try and get the result. I mean, how do you deal with that chameleon side?
It sounds so simple to say, but just be yourself. Like, just right. Be open. And I think, I mean, and the fact that we'll probably need to talk about it more with the team, but we have talked about that stuff before. It sort of demystifies it a lot. And the fact that as a leader, if you're saying it and talking about it, is actually saying that it's a thing. And in saying that, it can help you too. But again, it's about making sure you're aware of what your shortcomings are, making sure you build a good team around you, and ultimately hire good people who aren't going to, you know, pretend to be, you know, tougher than the next person, and are just going to be humble and open and deal with it. It's just having similar like-minded people around helps enormously. But yeah, you do have to have a bit of a chameleon, but I've just learned that stop pretending to be a manager and just be a manager and just be who you are. And if you're goofy at times, or you're funny at times, or you're not a nice person at times, so be it. It's all part of who you are.
All right, look, a couple more questions or topics before we move to the quick fire. So, like, one, you know, I just kind of want to get a little bit tactical for a sec, because, you know, you've gone from zero to almost 100 staff in, what, 18 months or less, which is, you know, astonishing level of growth. And I asked this for one of my previous guests in the show. How many staff did you have when you hired your first HR or recruitment person, and why?
That's an easy one, because we've just hired our first HR lead.
Oh, wow, you're late.
Yeah, it's super late. But we've got a really good one in Lucy. It depends. I haven't probably had the best experience with HR departments in the past, but I know that how important they are. So I had a little bit of a negative view on that. And for me also, I also felt that a big part of my role was hiring. You know, if you get the wrong hire wrong early, it can go badly and your culture can change and your hiring profile can change. So I think that was a big role of the CEO. It's just to make sure you build a strong team. Obviously, over time, you can't keep doing it. It's not sustainable to do it. So, and HR becomes more than hiring. So yeah, for us, maybe we could have done it earlier, but I think it seems like the right time. But yeah, it's been no small task hiring 100 people in that time frame. It's been amazing.
And have you put in, you know, one of the things that I really respected when I worked at Amazon was just how rigorous they were around operational processes, especially hiring. I mean, do you have a sort of rigorous process to make sure that you're not getting bad hires in?
No.
Right.
I'd like to.
That wasn't the answer I expected, but okay, it's honest.
No, I think with hiring, I think it's a little bit like a muscle where having to build up to multiple 100 people teams. I have interviewed so many people. It's probably similar, akin to a VC looking at companies. You start to look for the things you know you need in that particular time in your lifespan or that particular role, but more importantly, how they will gel with their peers and on the team they've been. So you become, I wouldn't say good at it, but you become a little bit quicker to pick up on the things you're looking for. If you're doing it for the first time, it's got to be different. If you're then dispersing across a bigger company like Amazon, that's totally different, because you can't control every hire. You can't be in any interview, so you need processes. We will increasingly have processes, but because we had a similar team hiring everyone, we knew how we were hiring, we knew what we were asking, we knew what we were looking for, and we're very aligned. But no, you're right, you have to have great processes to scale beyond where we're at now. That'll become more of our business, but it hasn't been to date.
Yeah. All right. Last question or topic, and it's a big one. It's combining ambition and progress and what's next. I mean, you said at the start, and you don't do what you've done in 18 months and raise as much money as you have in that time scale from some amazing people without just ambition and talent. But so first question, like, are you now where you expected to be when you launched? And the second question is, where do you expect to be?
No, I can comfortably say every founder thinks that they're onto something special and they're going to succeed. You can't start that journey if you don't think that. So I'm not sort of surprised in that way. But no, this has gone exceptionally well in terms of the speed, access to capital, putting the team together, getting the products, the way they've come together, the way the brands are merging, and then being in market for 3 months, the numbers that we've seen of businesses signing up is amazing and humbling. And like, I'm pleasantly surprised we've exceeded our year targets within a couple of months. So no, I didn't know that would happen. I hoped it would, obviously, and we were putting the pieces together to ensure that we had a better chance of success. But no, it's been incredible, and we're very, very thankful for the Australian businesses that we're taking a chance with us and hopefully enjoying the products we're bringing to them. But we're also in terms of the future, there is a bit to celebrate, but this is literally the start. Like, we are literally by definition getting started, and having thousands of businesses already is just the start. We openly say we want to be a multi-generational business. We want to change the Australian landscape. We want to go global. We want to bring this, what we think of vital products for businesses, to the world. So, we don't at all think, we've got somewhere, or this is closer to the end. It's just the start. We are ambitious by design. We've seen it in other markets that the other markets need the products that Zella are putting together. So we're looking forward to doing that. But there's a big challenge and problem in Australia where, financial services are too tightly held by four big oligopolistic banks, and they're not innovating to look after businesses nearly enough. And we believe we can. So we've got a big challenge and on our hands at the moment to do that. So we're definitely occupied with the present, but it got one eye also on the future.
And I mean, do you want to, have you put numbers around that scale of ambition or numbers that you're prepared to, I mean, I'm sure you have within your financial forecast that all VCs have seen, I mean, up and to the right, but I mean, how far up and to the right are you going to go?
We're actually quite, because we know the space, we know the inputs into modeling. It wasn't like we didn't look at TAM per se. We knew exactly the numbers that into the model, we knew exactly the return we could get, we knew exactly the economics to make it work. So our numbers were pretty scientific. But at the risk of sounding arrogant, like, they've been completely blown out of the water already. So we had to re-baseline straight away. So, which is a great problem to have. I mean, it was the first proof we saw was 3 days into the launch. And our products are sold via Officeworks as well as direct. And the Officeworks buyer turned around after day three and said we wanted, I think it was double or triple the order straight away, because they know what growth trajectories look like and early signs. And so we were like, oh, well, this is looking pretty good. And it's gone from strength to strength. And despite lockdowns, which is the surprising thing, it's continued to scale really quickly. So, it's something pretty special. So,
yeah. Anyway, look, Ben, we'll probably call it here and jump to the quickfire round. But before we do, just many congrats. I mean, I've interviewed loads of founders. I think you're probably the first one on the show that has only been going for a year and a half. But the progress you've made is remarkable. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Good luck with it. Any call outs to the audience, like if they're looking for a job or a payments provider, like what do you want to say to them?
That's a really good question. Thank you for asking. Absolutely. Businesses of any size, you now have an alternate to the banks. And whether you've been mistreated or overcharged or you want better products, definitely come to myzella.com and check us out. And we've got a great support team that can answer any questions, and hopefully we can help you out. Hiring is a big one. We're building a team quickly. I know a lot of people out there are either already in the tech and the high growth space, and so Zella might be that perfect next step for them. But even if you're not, even if you've been looking at taking a bit of a risk with your career and doing something different and moving into the world of tech and financial services, I think we're a pretty unique one that can offer a pretty amazing work environment and a good trajectory. So yeah, we'd love to hear from you. We've got heaps of roles open. And even if a role's not there, don't be afraid to reach out to any of us.
All right. So myzella.com.
Correct.
All right. Awesome. Let's do the quickfire round. Thanks, Ben. Do you have a book recommendation?
it's hard not to be a cliched one, and I've noticed a lot of tech people talk about this book, but Sapiens, for me, I don't think there's a better time for such an important, pertinent book to be read. So I thoroughly enjoyed reading that. So Sapiens.
You're the second guest in a row to mention that one.
There we go. I won't be the last, I'm sure. That's a good book.
No, actually, it probably is. Like, I don't think we've done an analysis. We should probably, jump in and pull a spreadsheet up. But I think Sapiens would be number one.
I'd say so.
You know, either that or The Hard Thing About Hard Things by Horowitz, Ben Horowitz. That's a great book too. Any other? Have you got a backup book?
I sort of think back on the books I've read, and probably White Teeth by Sadie Frost, I think it is, was great. I got into a little of Salman Rushdie books because I'd never read a book like Midnight's Children, which was, for me, the level of articulation in his writing is next level and just blows your mind the way he creates. So I enjoyed reading his books.
Yeah, great. I just finished Shuggie Bain, which won the Booker Prize. And it's a novel. I don't tend to read many novels, but it was set in Glasgow in the 80s, which is kind of when I grew up. But, I grew up in a nice part and went to private school.
Right.
And this guy in the book did not grow up, and it was not written or sanctioned by the Glasgow Tourist Board. It was kind of miserable. So anyways, great book. Don't get me wrong, but oh my God, it made me feel depressed. Sorry, that was a distraction. Right, podcast. Do you have a favorite podcast or recommendation?
I think a one-off podcast for me, The Dropout, which is the story about Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos.
Ah, yes, that was so good.
It's amazing, and whether you listen to the podcast, read the book, or I think there's probably a documentary. There is a documentary.
A documentary. I think there's a trial coming up, isn't there?
I assume so, because it feels like it's a bit unresolved.
I'm pretty sure it was going to be July this year. Our trial was set. But I can't remember. I mean, it's kind of, it's such a big story. Anyway, sorry, I'm interrupting.
No, by all means, I love that. Just the end-to-end nature of it. And then it's just amazing how some things, like stories like that, seem so obvious in hindsight, but at the time it really wasn't to a lot of people. But, just an amazing story, I listened to a lot of, the guy Raz How I Built This a while ago. Without sounding cliched, I liked his earlier stuff. But there's some really good stories. You can get some gold nuggets out of that. Really good stories of founders getting going. And it's a bit of a weird one, and not to everyone's taste, so I will admit that. But there's a podcast, I can't remember their names, but it's called The Dollop, two comedians. And it's just funny stuff where the concept, I don't know if you've listened to it, but one of the guys doesn't know what the topic is, and the topic's normally about a person in history. The other comedian just starts telling the story, and it's just his reaction to the absurdity of it. They do an amazing one on Donald Trump's story from being a kid all the way through. But not everyone's taste, but really, really funny guys.
All right, I like it. That's a good one. What about news source? Like, what do you read in the mornings or whenever?
A little bit cliched there. For me, the Australian Press, I think, still has an important role. And so I always, whether it's AFR, The Age, or The Australian, I'll read them all. Great coverage still despite this, and more important than ever as the media landscape changes. But then, obviously, have a look at the usual tech industry things like TechCrunch and what have you, just to see what's happening. But,
All right, what about favorite tech CEO?
I don't know. I didn't look up to too many CEOs in the traditional way, but I do come across people that I respect, and obviously little interactions I've had with Mike Starkey at Athena. I think he has a great sense of humility, ambition, and talent as well. I'm not just saying this, and it's going to sound very really loaded, but, Paul Bassett and Lee Fixell, I have no need to... really put their names out at the moment, but I've really enjoyed them because me, and I get little lessons from CEOs as opposed to macro lessons. And the thing I got from both of them is you can mix humility and that you can coexist that with ambition and prior success. So often those go out of kilter with a lot of CEOs, and I find with both Lee and Paul, really humble, down to earth, easy to talk to people. So like that, but from the outside, I've never met him, but Patrick Collison, Stripe, really smart guy, both brothers are, but just their sort of audacious growth they've taken over the years. I think they're a lot to be proud of and built a great
business. Yeah. I mean, that's an amazing business. It's huge now. I mean, it's over $100 billion worth, I think. All right, great. Do you have a favorite app on your phone? This is like non-work related. I kind of try and push people into that.
Yeah, I have one which is a really weird one. Not really weird, but I'm in Melbourne, so I should not care about the weather because the weather, you know, is obviously crap and it changes all the time. But there's an app called YR, so the two letters, YR, and it's a Norwegian weather app. And they just do a phenomenal job of compiling data points from around the world, and they put it into a visualization. Though as tacky and simplistic as it is, you can actually see the weather that's coming. So I don't know why my brain likes that, but rather than looking at data points, whether you can see what the weather and the sun's going to be at, what the size of the moon and where it's going to be and whether it's going to rain or snow, and being a bit of an avid skier as well, I've always used it then. So, yeah, I don't know. YR is an interesting one.
Wow. And skiing, like have you been to the Victorian ski resorts this year?
Please don't talk about that. We've been in something called a lockdown for a while, so we can't go. Sorry. But I'm hopefully at some point soon I'll be able to go, because apparently it's not. Well,
yeah, no, I think it's snowed a lot. Productivity tool. Like, what do you use to stay productive?
It's a cliche, but Slack, obviously, it's changed the world of communication in businesses. We use it all the time. It's not perfect in my view, but I think it's an amazing tool, and it works well in, within Zella. And the other one that I just love seeing is simplicity, and there's a few different versions of this, but Figma. For me, the simplicity, we're very close with products. We're constantly building, designing new products. So the collaborative nature of Figma is awesome, and how fast you can move to get from just a wireframe through to something that looks almost tangibly ready to launch is pretty crazy.
Yeah, cool. Love it. TV show, do you watch telly? If so, what do you watch?
I don't get as much time as I'd like to, but being in lockdown, we've probably got more time than we wanted. Recently is a bit of a weird one. My kids got me into this, but Loki. And that was a surprise because it was such a cleverly written show. And so it wasn't just some sort of superhero thing. It was just really kooky and different, a different take on the story. So I was shocked by that and really, really enjoyed it. But I guess
it does have a shitty superhero title. Is he the God of Mischief? I mean, it's like, really?
Yeah, it is. But he's made the most of it. And he's definitely gone on with it a bit. And yeah, it's obviously a bad luck story all the way through. But yeah, just the way they put it together, the visuals are amazing, and the actors, actors do a great job. So really, really surprised. Is Silicon Valley, and that's a cliched one. And watching that when I was going through getting to know a San Francisco based company, like the similarities and the accuracies, but the humor on it is hilarious.
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, it's such a shame it's over now.
Yeah.
But yeah, they did an incredible job. Even just getting the cameos coming in, I mean, it was amazing.
Definitely.
Loved it. I've been watching a bit. Like the Rick and Morty new season is out. Have you ever seen that?
I haven't. I'll take a look.
Check it out. It's on Netflix. Okay. It's rather juvenile humor, adult cartoon. Anyway, it's very funny.
Well, sometimes you need that, right? Like the world's a very serious place at the moment. So a little bit of escapism never went astray.
Yeah, I think so. All right, very last question. If you got approached by TED to do one of those 15-minute talks, like what topic would you talk about?
I don't know, but I'd probably just stay in my lane, and some of the great questions you'd ask, I'd probably extrapolate a little bit more on that, resilience, what it takes, and probably talking, about some of the difficulties of, and despite the halo effect in tech and high growth companies, about the reality of it is a lot more warts and all, and probably talk a little bit more about that, and just make sure, as I said, stay in my lane and talk about stuff I know. And
Cool. Yeah. Love it. All right, look, we are out of time, but Ben, thank you so much. You're a busy man, and you've carved out a bunch of time, so I think you've got to get back, and you probably got to hire another 5 people today, so I should let you get on with that. But thank you very much, and thanks everyone for listening. We'll see you in the next one.
Thank you very much. Cheers.